House Committee on Revenue for March 27, 2009 will come to order. We're going to open a work session on House Bill 2068. Colleagues, the purpose of this work session is to have a discussion about some of the transfer issues, and I note that Mr. Graney is here and may want to join in that conversation with us. Chris, did you have something on this?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. As you recall, House Bill 2068 had some kind of template language, the idea being creating one place in statute that defines how credits can be transferred, kind of the mechanics of that, so that as the Assembly moves forward and wants any future tax credit or even the existing tax credits to be transferred, they can just refer to this template language as a way of clarifying the details of how that would be transferred. And so to that end, and following up on the Chair's comments, Vice Chair Benz has chaired a work group trying to tackle this issue. And in your packets, you have two handouts, one that is titled Tax Credit Transfers in Statute, and that has some yellow highlighting on it. And then there's another one, Tax Credit Transfer Policy Considerations. So I guess just to get the conversation going, to provide some context, in statute currently there are 66 credits that are kind of active credits that people can take. Of those 66, there are eight that refer to some kind of transfer, and those are the eight that are listed in the tax credit transfer statute page that you have in your packet. So continuing on that context, just to kind of highlight the situation we have right now, I've highlighted in yellow there the specific language that refers to the transfer of the credit, and that varies a little bit from statute to statute, and that's kind of the source of some of the administrative difficulties in defining or understanding and implementing legislative intent behind the transfer. So to just run through those quickly, the business energy facilities, the language there says the owner of a facility may transfer a tax credit for the facility in exchange for a cash payment equal to the present value of the tax credit. The film production development contributions credit says a taxpayer who has received a tax credit certificate under this section may sell the certificate to another taxpayer without really defining what sell means. Alternative fuel vehicles, the owner of an alternative fuel vehicle as defined in ORS 469.160 may transfer a tax credit in exchange for a cash payment equal to the present value of the tax credit. So that's kind of similar to the Betsy piece. The alternative fuel stations, the certificate and verification form described under ORS 469-170 may be transferred by the contractor to the first purchaser of the dwelling that incorporates the fueling station. And that has a little bit different flavor there because you're talking about somebody who perhaps builds a home and then transfers the credit to the homeowner. The farmworker housing lender credit, if the lending institution sells the loan to another lending institution, then the credit shall pass to the assignee or transferee of the loan. Basically, the credit follows the loan. Then that credit also has another type of transfer on the second page where it says the lending institution that is not subject to taxation under this chapter may sell or otherwise transfer the credit allowed to the lending institution. So it has that sell language. Then the farmworker housing construction credit specifies that an owner or operator of a farmworker housing may transfer all or a portion of the credit to one or more contributors. So that indicates that possibly the credits can be broken up. And then the biomass production or collection simply says a person that has obtained a tax credit under ORS 315-141 may transfer the credit for consideration. And the statute doesn't define exactly what consideration is. And I think we'll hear a little bit about some of the difficulties in implementing that statute and interpreting the term consideration. And then the last one, the diesel truck engines for the repower retrofit, says that a person that has obtained a tax credit certification may transfer the cost certification in exchange for consideration. So kind of broadly, you have just general language around transfer the credit, and then you have kind of selling it for consideration. And so that kind of sets the stage. When you have the administrative agencies trying to administer the policy, they have run into some difficulties in interpreting exactly what the legislative intent is. So that's kind of the context for the situation we have in trying to come up with a template for what the Assembly wants to do with the policies. Okay, so that's that. The second piece is the tax credit transfer policy considerations. And this is the outline that the work group has been focusing on so far. And to start with the work group took a step back and tried to get at why to allow transferability to begin with. So it's really, you know, contemplating the world, so to speak, I guess. And in one way or another, the most dominant one that comes to mind is financing some of these projects. And again, the Betsy projects tend to overshadow the conversation because that is the most prominent transfer credit and that has the largest dollar volume involved in there. And you have the five-year credit. So it's a financing mechanism to allow these entities to undertake the projects. Presumably, behind the policy that the Assembly has implemented, the idea is to have not necessarily as many projects as possible be undertaken, but up to some sort of efficiency level to encourage as many projects to be taken. And then within that financing piece, you also have opening it up to nonprofits or local governments, basically entities that don't pay tax. By allowing a transfer of the credit, these entities can undertake these projects and then transfer or sell the credit to a taxpayer who can then use the credit. It's another way to get the projects done. So I think those were the two big pieces in terms of why. There was a lot of discussion on why the transferability. Mm-hmm. And that really is the theoretical backdrop.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to compliment Chris on his hard work on this because he was pretty patient in dealing with other members of the work group and me. That's the truth of it. But the transferability piece and the why to allow it, a remark about the five-year use of the tax credit in larger operations is of interest, because if you're going to sell a tax credit that can only be used over 5 years, folks are going to need the money first, and thus they use it as a financing device. They sell the credit, and there's a discount back. And so there was much discussion about whether or not the state could collapse that 5 years into just one. But, of course, the cost to the state would be enormous because we would have to basically give that tax credit all in 1 year. We can't afford it. So that meant we had to spread, for the state purposes, the credit out over five. Thus, that requires that someone be able to sell it and take a discount if we're going to allow it to be used for financing. The issue then becomes, if we're going to use that device, is the state receiving full value for its investment in that project? And thus, the focus is on the amount of the discount and the mechanism of allowing the transferability to occur. And there's a lot of discussion about the mechanism of the discount and whether our pricing of the tax credit was adequate. And this took us into whether or not the market was broad enough to allow full and correct sale of the discount, of the credit subject to a discount. But that took us again back to where Chris started, which was, why are we doing all of this? And the answer appears to be, well, if we want these larger energy facilities to happen and we are going to be investing in them, we as a state can't put all the money in the form of a grant right at the front end. Indeed, we're going to have to use this tax credit device. But that's a policy call. And are we, as a state, going to invest in these projects knowing that the tax expenditure is going to be discounted back and we're not going to receive necessarily dollar for dollar. In fact, we're not going to get dollar for dollar into those facilities. That's a policy call for this group, and whether or not we want to continue to spread tax credits out over future years with the incumbent reduction in value because of the necessary discount. So our hope was that we could place these policy issues before this group and you could let us know what you're thinking when it comes to transferability first.
Okay. Did you want to hear from Mr. Graney?
Yes, for sure.
This morning? Because I think he has another event today. Is that right?
I believe my name for Dr.
Oh, Quinn. Thank you. Yes, Representative Berger.
I can't tell you how much I appreciate this document because it frames the issue in a way that I have never seen it framed. And the policy issues aside, I'm looking at some of these where the language has been in statute, they're known to work, they're kind of settled in my mind. Farm worker housing lender tax credits. I mean, I don't know how when we enacted it. If the language is not understandable or the policy is not well understood, we better think about how much farm worker housing we have built under this and decide, you know, are you sure you want to mess in language that has worked? Because that's I'm taking this, by the way, in my own mind, from this flyover on transferability to right to the weeds here. Okay, we got eight in front of us. I think some of these could be taken right off the table because I'm not in favor of mucking with what has worked pretty darn well. This whole discussion comes out of some of our more recent tax credits, specifically the business energy, some of these alternative fuel, and most specifically, I think, the biomass piece that maybe aren't working very well. And so, I mean, I think there's some compelling reasons for transferability, and that could be asked, but I'm not so wild about changing language that's worked fine because we have language other places in statute that doesn't work so well. Let's work on the problems, not try and create more problems in some really good existing tax credits, is sort of my thinking on this that I'd like to put on the table.
Okay. Chris, go ahead.
Yeah. I think that's an excellent point, Representative. And one of the values of trying to frame it in terms of all of the language that might be affected would be to make sure that if any new language were to address the existing problems, that it doesn't step on existing ones. So that if under whatever amendments possibly come forward, and if that defines transfer a certain way or defines selling a credit a certain way, it seems useful to be aware, okay, well, we need to make sure.
Exactly.
So that's part of that was the intent of trying to.
And it's beautifully framed, Chris. So. I really appreciate it.
I noticed that some of the, at least some of the credits that Representative Berger refers to already require the involvement of the Department of Revenue. Farm worker housing lender requires that the Department of Revenue shall by rule establish procedures for transferring credits under this section. The film production development contributions requires a notice to the Department of Revenue. This discussion came up during the special session last year in a number of conversations. The ones I recall had I was involved with Chair Burdick of the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee, and trying to understand how transfers worked and what the issues around them might be, and deciding then that we were not ready to do anything with them. But the key issue at that time wasn't the issue of present value or market, although market did come up. I think the key issue at that point had to do with the maintenance of an audit trail for the purposes of the Department of Revenue. Which I guess hasn't really been involved in the conversation so far.
Yes, please.
That leads into the second handout there, the tax credit transfer policy considerations.
Okay.
The bullet point one is the why issue, kind of that sky blue thing. Then items 2 through 8 get down to some of the mechanics. And in part of that, the administrative and compliance is certainly a piece of that. I think revenue and energy can speak to their experience on some of these credits, the biomass credit as well as the Betsy, and that certainly factored into highlighting some of these administrative issues. The mechanics, you know, the number of times a credit may be transferred, which types of tax entities can receive a credit, you know, S corporations, partnerships, LLCs, those kinds of things. State agency certification, not all of the credits currently require some sort of state agency certification. It may not be necessary for all of them to require it. Transfer price determination and the applicability of the transfer credits. Kind of all of these items is what the work group has been kind of trying to march through.
Chair?
Yes,
If it's the pleasure of the committee to retain full transferability, then I think it has to be because the device, once we spread the credit out over 5 years, if you don't allow transferability, it's not going to work the way we hope it would, because many of the people are not going to be able to retain the credit and offset it against income because they won't have income. That's the nature of the business we're trying to promote. So, if it's going to be transferred, if we're going to have this affect what we're trying to get done, then transferability, we can probably pass over it. The mechanics of transfer are extremely interesting, and the Department of Revenue should weigh in on this and explain the costs that go with maximum transferability will give us the most, the smallest discount in looking over the 5 years. Bigger market, more people bidding, discount shrinks, more dollars go to the party that's building the facility. So the trouble is there's a significant cost to building the machinery to allow that market to operate. And so the department is best suited to explain that cost, and actually both departments, energy and revenue.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you want to be heard this morning?
Sure.
Please. Yeah. As you can tell, we're exploring. And if you have some thoughts on both where you think we ought to be going and the questions that Representative Bentz just asked, I think we'd appreciate hearing about that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mike Graney, Director of the Department of Energy, and have asked Debbie Buchanan to come forward from Department of Revenue, too. We've both been working with Representative Bentz on these issues. Transferability has been important for the Business Energy Tax Credit Program because it has allowed more projects to go forward. People who don't have tax liability initially, in addition to nonprofits and local governments, probably about half of our users of the tax credit now are using the pass-through. So it's a substantial portion, and by dollar amount is probably about two-thirds. So most of the large projects, as well as many of the smaller projects, are using the transferability feature. I think it's generally worked well. In the course of that, there have been some questions, technical questions of just uncertainty of how it could be transferred, and in part that was the reason for the introduction of House Bill 2159 by Department of Revenue, as well as looking at House Bill 2068. But then in addition, we've had interest expressed by a number of people making the transferability more open, say multiple times, and carving projects into small pieces, very small pieces that you could transfer or sell as a block to multiple investors. And as Representative Bentz was pointing out, that gets very complicated. I don't think the current law allows that, but it's not entirely clear. You can't have more than one transfer for the tax credit. And as you do multiple transfers, the audit trail and the work both for our agency and Department of Revenue would be substantially more than it is now. So that's a factor to take into account as well as to what way you'd want to go on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. And I would like to just talk about some of the administrative issues that we have seen and follow up on Representative Berger's comment about those that have been on the books for a long time. If I look at this document and I look at the farm worker housing construction credit as an example on the second page, that's 315-169. It says an owner-operator of farm worker housing may transfer all or a portion of the credit to one or more contributors. It seems fairly clear. It's the owner-operator may transfer all or a portion to one or more contributors. So you have who can do the transfer, what may be transferred, and who may receive it. If you look at other language, it's not quite as clear. For example, the biomass credit says a person that has obtained the credit may transfer the credit for consideration to a taxpayer. So the questions we have, and we receive legal advice that when the legislature uses different words, it intends different things. So we look at this and we say, what's different about this? Well, one thing that's different is a person that has obtained a tax credit. That's not the same as an owner-operator of a project. May transfer the credit, all or a portion. This doesn't say all or a portion, so is it all or nothing? It's not the same as the previous one, which says all or a portion. So are we to assume that this means the whole credit must be transferred? And that was one of the things we were trying to clarify in House Bill 2159. For consideration, what does that mean? We had people who couldn't use the tax credit themselves because they didn't have enough liability, so they gave it to relatives. Is there consideration involved there? Did you intend for there to be a transfer of cash for that transfer of the credit? We said if there's no consideration, there's no transfer, so we disallow those. In other cases, employers were giving them to employees in lieu of paying increased wages or in lieu of bonuses. It seems there you may have consideration because there are services performed, but it's not entirely clear. To a taxpayer, what do you mean by to a taxpayer? What is a taxpayer? If you look at the top of that page, the farmworker housing lender credit, it says that one may be a lending institution may sell or otherwise transfer to a taxpayer that is subject to taxation under this chapter. This chapter is 317. Those are corporate taxpayers, so we know exactly who may receive the credit there. For biomass, what is a taxpayer? Is a partnership a taxpayer? They don't pay tax. Income from a partnership is distributed to the partners, so our interpretation of those words is the partnership cannot receive a credit under this section. And that's not clear either, and we've been challenged on that a bit. But we don't know what you meant by to a taxpayer. So those are the issues that we've run into administratively in trying to deal with more and more credits that are allowed to be transferred, different words being used, sometimes words that are ambiguous in nature, and then how do you want us to interpret that and apply it? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Would it be useful to have, I don't know if this works or not, what I'm about to ask. I don't know whether it works because these all have different purposes. But would it be useful from the administrative point of view to have a single statute that had been well crafted and that had where the legislature had considered all of these issues you've raised and to administer all of them in the same way?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that was the intent of House Bill 2068
to I think it was
craft
too.
A statute that said if the legislature says a credit may be transferred, these are the parameters for allowing the transfer of that credit. I don't know whether it can be successful or not, but that's what we were hoping we might be able to get. If not that, at least some clarity around those that are now unclear.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In our work group, the discussion focused on a lot of different things, but one of them was the trade-off the state makes in developing this machinery for transfer on the one hand and utilizing the other much more simple but effective device we're currently using on the other, which is the Department of Energy finding a pass-through partner, working a deal very quickly, efficiently, but possibly at the cost of maybe not exposing that purchase opportunity to the full market. Could you address just generally the type of mechanism that we as a state would have to create if we were going to do something other than what we're currently doing with the transfer process?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vance, I think there are some choices that you would need to make as to how much of a compliance effort you would want the department to engage in order to minimize leakage from that system. Currently, we verify accuracy of credits claimed on returns generally on audit or during processing. Someone may look at a credit on a return and say, this looks fairly large for the other information shown on the return. They'll ship it to an auditor. Someone may contact the taxpayer and ask for verification of the audit. We can also ask for lists of taxpayers who've received credits from issuing agencies and do the work that way and match it up with the returns. If what you're looking for is free transferability in a free and open market, then the question is, how much compliance work do you want us to do to try to ensure upfront that those credits are appropriately claimed, rather than trying to do that on the back end through those types of audits? Because the more transfers are involved, it seems to me the more opportunity there is for that type of leakage to occur.
And the question possibly should be also addressed to Director Graney to explain how our current process works.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Representative Benz, for the business tax credit and the two relating to alternative fuels, it's a present value transfer. It's not a market mechanism, so that we calculate and we do this in rule, and we'll review that each year. The amount that the transfer payment should be based on the current value in 1 year of the tax credit over 5 years. So for 50% tax credit right now, somebody buying the tax credit has to pay 33.5% to receive 50%. On a 35% tax credit, they have to pay 25.5%. So that's a grant that turns the tax credit into a grant to the company or the nonprofit that's using, that developed the energy facility. And there's advantages and disadvantages of doing a present value versus a market. Some of the advantages are there's certainty on both sides, both the purchaser and the seller. For planning purposes, they know what the cost will be and how much income they'll receive. Disadvantage is you could have more or less depending on the market situation. You also could have uneven bargaining situations, and you could also just have bad timing in the market for one side or the other, and that could affect the pace of developing energy projects. So that I think that was part of the reason at the time when this feature was added, since it was new in our program, to start with a present value range approach that would provide more initial certainty.
How do you calculate present value?
Mr. Chairman, it's a combination of the rate of inflation and there are other economic factors that would tie into expected rate of return for investments compared to other competing investments of a like nature.
And what time of the year do you recalculate this?
I think we always look at it every time we update our rules, and that's on an annual basis, probably by the first of the year, each year. We have not changed the calculation since last year, though, for either percentage.
Since 2007?
Seven, yes.
Okay.
But we will be looking at it again.
I would hope so.
Yes.
The market is very, very different.
It right certainly now. Is.
If I were a large company taxpayer and I knew I could buy a 5-year stream of tax reductions for two-thirds of the face value, it would not be hard for me to calculate that I'd do a whole lot better on that than I would on Treasury bills right now.
Right, Mr. Chairman. And that's actually an interesting dynamic of that problem, because by that approach, there are times where we have a surplus of buyers looking for the credit, and we have at times where it's hard to transfer the credit. So there, and that's part of the interest, I think, from what you're hearing from some of the financial community of making this more wide open.
Representative Betts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Perhaps either of you could address the choice that the policy choice that the committee has between continuing the approach that the department is currently using, which is to adjust the present value on the one hand, versus the mechanism that would be put into place if we were going to go to a more market-oriented approach, and all of the audit improvements or increase in audit requirements that would go with opening the door to many more buyers, because the current arrangement allows for a fairly narrow scope of buyers. The market-oriented approach would allow for any number of buyers, thus increasing the pressure, I think, as I understand it, on the department to increase the number of possible audits, so that we would reduce the chance of I forgot the word you use, leakage. Yes. There's the choice. It looks like we, on the one hand, run the risk of the public saying we're not maximizing our return because we are giving too great a discount in the current sale arrangement, on the one hand, versus the cost that we would have to incur in making a more robust system in your department to make sure we didn't have leakage. I just want the committee to be clear on that type of a policy choice. So maybe you could speak to it for a moment.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, the other states have looked at this issue, and one I know of, Iowa, has I think pretty much established its Department of Revenue as the go-to place for taxpayers to transfer credits. So if a person receives a credit and wants to transfer it, I believe that they report to the Department of Revenue information about the credit and about who it's being transferred to, and then the Department of Revenue tracks that information. I don't know about the costs involved in doing that, but it does seem that that would be an option for the legislature to consider. I also don't have a good idea of what it would cost our agency to set up something like that, but that would be an option. Again, it's really just a policy choice for you as to whether you want that type of focus. A different option might be not to go to completely open and free transferability, but something in between. If you wanted to have it transferable to partnerships, then there could be identifying information on the tax credit certificate that goes to a partnership that's reported on K-1s that are filed by the partners of a partnership. So there is some tracking information there rather than just a free and open type of selling.
Mr. Chair, I think that one of the issues that is in this current bill, that is 2068, and I think there's other bills that suggest that we should allow transfer of these credits to partnerships and thus allow all of the partners that happen to be in that partnership the opportunity to utilize a portion of that tax credit. And the challenge then for the department is making sure that there isn't leakage or misuse or abuse of that tax credit once it's transferred into that partnership. And currently we are not allowing that. Is that my understanding?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vance, our interpretation of at least some of these transferable credits is that because the legislature said that the credit may be transferred to a taxpayer, and we've been advised that partnerships are not taxpayers, we're interpreting those words to mean that partnerships cannot be the transferees. So it's only the words that have gotten us to that conclusion.
So that means we are not at this point allowing a transfer to a partnership. We would, though, allow a transfer to an LLC.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vance, I believe that we are not allowing the transfer of a credit to a partnership, nor would it go to an LLC that is being taxed as a partnership. If partners in a partnership wanted to receive that credit, the credit would be issued to the partners individually, not to the partnership, and distributed to the partners, but individually to each partner.
And that's the current process for the Betsy also, for the business tax credit.
No, Mr. Chair, I better follow
yes,
up on that.
Yeah, please.
Okay, I'm going to have to go back and have you explain that second step because I didn't follow it. My understanding is, under the current statute, you could allow the transfer to an LLC that was being taxed as a corporation because that would be a taxpayer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vance, I believe that's correct.
Right, and then, but if that LLC had adopted the more usual approach to be taxed as a partnership, are we currently allowing that transfer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vance, not to my knowledge, because it is not a taxpayer since it is a partnership. And if the partners of that, the members of that LLC wish to receive the credit, they would have to receive it individually as individual taxpayers, not as members of an LLC, or not through the LLC, through its distribution.
Mm-hmm. So we could simply say that that group of people, we would ignore the LLC for purposes of what you just suggested. They, as individuals, would be free to purchase the tax credit directly if they chose to do so.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vance, that is the current treatment, yes.
Yes, and then follow up, Mr. Ferris.
Yes.
The idea would then be that having acquired the tax credit, they would be the first ones to have done so, and then at that point they could not transfer it to someone else.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vance, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
All right. This would be a great time for others to chime in on issues of concern. I think one of the points of holding this kind of a meeting is to get some guidance from the committee on, so the work group can proceed to amendments that will actually accomplish what the committee would like to see done. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess one of the things that I think about when I look at transferability of credits is that what's the purpose of the credit? And purpose of credits, to me, is to is to help a particular project or type of projects, whatever it is we're giving the credits to, to establish itself, to operate, whatever that credit's for. And if we transfer that credit more than once, and that's one of the things we're talking about, the second transfer does nothing for the project that we're trying to help, because they don't get any of that. It's they've done their thing, they're finished, they've given the credit away, and now someone else owns that credit, and the second transfer helps someone that we didn't intend or don't know, or you know, that's a thought that I have. Now, on the other side of that, of course, is the fact that some people wouldn't buy those transfers if they couldn't sell them later. So that's the other side of that, and that's the one thing that I have a little bit of a problem dealing with, and that's just something I wanted to throw out.
Okay, Representative Berger.
Yeah, and I have a little different view on this philosophically. If I go to the store and I want to buy a dish strainer, it is the dish strainer that I want. And when we develop these tax credits, they are we're buying something, a specific item with this mechanism, be it farm worker housing, Betsy. There's a policy thing that we're buying with this money. And it's money. Okay, we all agree it's money.
Yes.
So it's the same thing as me going to the store and buying a dish strainer. It's the dish strainer I want. All right? The money is my way of getting it. So when I hand that money to the guy at the grocery store, I don't ask him, okay, now you've got my dollar, but I want to hang on to what you do with that dollar for the next transfer and the next transfer and the next transfer. Because I've got my dish strainer and he's got his dollar. And in this venue, I mean, I don't know how our policy, the transfer has to be around what we're trying to do with the policy, how we're spending the money, not how closely we can we need to go back and say, yeah, but he transferred that dollar to, he bought drugs with it. I didn't want him to do that. I mean, you understand what I'm saying? How much are we going to expend if the transfer if the credit has value, then somebody has to buy it, and that somebody now owns this dollar, and I don't know how far-reaching we can be in controlling that. If our policy, we got the dish drainer, or we got the Betsy, or we got the farm working, I guess that's how I am thinking philosophically about this transferability thing.
Mm-hmm. Representative Riley?
Thank you. I understand exactly what you're saying, and that's one of the sides of it that I see. The other side of it that I see, however, is that this is not a dish drainer. This is something that's going to cost us money later on. We didn't just give away that dollar. We gave away the right for someone to charge us a dollar, and that's a different situation. So,
well, I certainly don't want it to go to drugs.
Thank you.
Don't. I want that on the record, Representative.
We didn't give away money. We gave away the right for someone to charge us a dollar later on.
Railway plan.
Yeah. So who do we want to give that dollar to? Is right.
Well, could I add to the discussion? It seems to me that the point of having a tax credit at all is to, as Representative Berger pointed out earlier, is to encourage action on the part of some person out in the economy. I mean, we want them to do something, so we offer a tax credit. The point of whether or not we allow a transfer is really to establish the value of that credit to that person. Whether and then the efficiency of that transfer value becomes important to us, because it may determine how much of a tax credit we have to give in the first place. Mm-hmm. If, for example, we get two-thirds, the person who receives the tax credit originally gets only two-thirds of the value of it. In the market, because of the present value argument that Mr. Graney makes, then in effect we're having to pay half again what we might have to pay if we simply gave them cash. And so when we, as we talk about these transferences, it's in our interest perhaps to figure out a way, if we can, to increase the amount that the original tax credit receiver gets for that tax credit on the initial transaction. If we can do it in a way, getting back now to the Department of Revenue, or even the Energy, if we can do it in a way that keeps our costs down. Because after all, this is a financial issue. Every penny we spend on the administration of this is a penny added to our costs of making this thing work. So, I mean, and there are probably some other considerations well, of course, the leakage one, which I think is a polite way of saying you're getting cheated somehow, is another consideration. And I believe that the whole conversation, at this level at least, revolves around those issues. I may have missed one or two, perhaps, but I think they revolve around those issues. That leaves aside completely the question of whether we should offer a tax credit in the first place at all. That's a different kind of question. Representative Call.
Yeah, I just wanted to make explicit just a couple concerns I have. I think I'm actually pretty close to being in agreement with Representative Berger's characterization, and my real concern with transferability is that if we're going out to buy a dish drainer, making sure that once we've transferred the credits, what we're getting is the dish drainer. And if we're talking about leakage, you know, we the easier it is to transfer a credit, the harder accountability is at the down the road. That, to me, I think, is my concern. And then the last thing is on the opposite side of this, is that I do think that the tax credit becomes more valuable the more fungible it is. The easier it is to transfer, the more valuable it will be to the people who want to have it. And so I guess those to me are the two competing interests in this thing. I'm just sharing my thoughts because I don't actually have any idea how to get it balance those competing interests in any more efficient way than I think is existing in statute or is being presented by this law. I think that there's a good balance struck on either side of this thing. So,
can we move this question to the Department of outside of the legislature? The reason the issue is this, right? Right now we're dealing with rough numbers, $200 million a year in Betsy credits. If we can improve the transference value by 1%, that's $2 million a year. I mean, it's not a small amount of money. We have increased the incentive to do the work by $2 million a year. On the other hand, if it's very, very expensive to manage something that, as Representative Call suggests, then we might be better off foregoing the $2 million just because of the administration costs. It occurs to me that to some extent, figuring out the amount of further transfer, the size of transfers, the number of transferees, and the interaction between those issues and the value of the transfer in the first place might be more sensibly handled at an administrative level rather than at the legislative level. If the department, I'm making up an idea here, and I'd like your thoughts, recognizing that it's not a final thought for either of us. But I'm wondering if the Department of Revenue were charged with managing transfers, and it was told to the department, in the process of managing transfers, you decide how many transferees there can be and whether there can be subsequent transfers or not, and what the minimum price for a transfer has to be, and judge that on the basis of the value of the transfer to the original credit receiver and the cost of the department in managing it, because those go against each other, and write your rules accordingly. And be prepared to modify the rules if it turns out you were wrong on any of those considerations the first time through. This may be too much of a question to answer today, as I'm thinking about it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
But it does occur to me that maybe what we ought to be doing is setting up a set of criteria for you to use in making these judgments rather than trying to do it ourselves, because we have no expertise in that area. We have no sense of what the actual administrative costs are or of the difficulties you'll have in dealing with leakage.
A very interesting idea, Mr. Chair.
And then, of course, we'd have to be satisfied with the rules you came up with. Yes.
Mr. Chair, if you took an approach like that, one of the things to address the administrative costs, in our case, whatever added responsibilities we would have to do, the user of the tax credit program pays for. They have to pay for all our program costs under current statute. And you could look at doing analogous provisions, if it made sense, on okay. the other tax credits that were transferable as a way of reducing the direct cost on the state of administration. And if, in fact, this approach really increases the value of the credits to everybody involved, then that administrative cost they should pay for directly rather than having the state general fund pay for it.
And, Mr. Chair, just as an initial thought, maybe something of a hybrid program would work, where, for example, energy continues with the role it has now in finding that initial partner for, to participate as a financer of the project. But then if there if there's a subsequent transfer that you desire and that would be allowed, then that would involve the Department of Revenue. The farm worker housing credit, as an example, that's transferable to contributors. So financers of the farm worker housing project can receive a portion of the credit. And maybe that's the initial distribution of the credit. Then if one of those find that they can't use it, they come to the Department of Revenue to do the transaction on a subsequent sale.
Of course, I'm not suggesting that you'd be responsible for helping them find a buyer.
No, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The interesting thing about this exercise has been observing the state involved in the creation of a financing device and kind of in the business of banking in a kind of a backwards way. And I know in talking to folks from both energy and revenue, it doesn't quite fit what they're about, but they're both doing it because we have told them to. So pulling back to the actual difficulty that I see, it's measured by the number of people that are lining up to buy these credits. And the longer the line, the more one realizes someone isn't doing their job quite right, because that means the pricing is wrong.
Yeah.
And thus, the greater the interest in buying the credits, the more likely we're not doing it right. And so I don't want to find ourselves later being blamed for failing to have created this mechanism correctly. And that's why I was so interested in participating in this work group. The challenge, I think, is I would very much like to delegate that challenge to someone else, because it's tough to go back and forth between cost of creating a correct mechanism for being a bank on the one hand versus just getting the thing done on the other, which seems to be the expediency piece is what has won out because of the incredible demand for this opportunity to utilize state money. So I'm not sure we can get away from that policy call. I think we need to say something like, we're going to bite the bullet and create an appropriate mechanism, or we're going to take the risk of looking like we're giving away the state's money for too little. So I think we need to make that choice. Either we're going to take the risk and look bad, mm-hmm. or we're going to spend the money to do it right. There.
Okay. I got it. Is that in reference to my comment or not?
No, of course not, Mr. Chair. It was not.
because it didn't seem to me as though it was.
No, actually, it might have been slightly prompted.
And what would you prefer that we do? Or do you have a preference?
I do have a preference. Given the nature of the devices we have to work with, it would be my thought that we should encourage the Energy Department to do a more aggressive pricing of that which we that's what we have, maybe an every 3 month pricing, or maybe an every 2 month pricing, as we then take your idea and ask the department to come back with a series of proposed rules to tighten it down. But that's how I would do it. It's not getting us quite where we need to go, but we don't have the money to create a bank.
Or the expertise either.
Correct.
We've seen how people with great expertise have managed banks recently, and I'm not sure we want to be in that role.
Right.
Although I take a swing at it.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We don't want to make someone miss their doctor's appointment. I think.
Oh, you're right. Oh, thank you.
That's okay.
We appreciate your being here today, and I certainly don't want to be here when you need to be somewhere else.
Oh, that's okay, Mr. Chairman. If there's any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, David. Let me just add one point as he's leaving the room. I think one of the ways of fixing that particular transfer statute would simply be to make it clear that we don't mean a particular price point, but a minimum price. established based on present value. And that would allow for people to have an informal auction over who is actually going to get it if there's more than one potential buyer.
Yes. Good idea.
Yeah. All right, is there anything else on this today? Is this helpful to you as you're working on the work group on this issue?
Very much so.
Okay. All right. All right, well, with that, then, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2068. Colleagues, we don't have the amendments that we need to open 2067. So, do you want to carry it over?
I think we'll have them today.
You think we'll get them today? Okay. Well, let's carry it over until Monday. Until Monday. Let's carry over House Bill, the work session on House Bill 2067 until Monday. And let's open a work session on House Bill 2091.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Ever since early this morning, I felt there was a very special day today. I kept looking for the reason. Then I discovered that today is a product of the month and the year. It's 9/27, 3/27/09.
Mr. Chair, may I interrupt?
Yeah, yes, Representative Berger.
It's disturbing to me.
Just
on a general level, that anyone would think about such things.
Then, Mr. Chair,
it sort of speaks to a professional problem.
Well, Representative
Point Berger, of personal preference.
Representative Berger,
that is amazing.
It does require a peculiar mind.
It is amazing
to do the work that that we require our staffs to do at all.
Well, some of us are just thinking about that cup of coffee in the morning, and others are clearly thinking in a completely different level.
That's true. It's a good thing we have a few of us who care about numbers.
Mr. Chair.
Mazin, please go ahead.
Then, after that, sitting in the earlier in the hearing, I understand why this is a special day. As Representative Berger was talking about the price and the dollar and so on, I said, oh, my God, we turned them into economists.
No!
That's how special this day is.
God help us.
We'll be coming at the date next week.
However, Mr. Chair, good to go back to the bill in hand. House Bill 2091, we have heard on February 5th, and at that time, to refresh your memory about this bill, the Secretary of State, the Audits Division, was proposing to change the way by which the amounts of money that is kept in their accounts from being in the general fund type of bookkeeping and banking to sequestering those funds for the purpose of having the interest that is coming from the federal payments and allocation to be completely identified for the purpose that the federal government will not penalize the audits division for doing so. However, at that time when we talked about it, the bill did not have all the pieces that needs to be worked out. And then you have in front of you what we looked at this time, the -1 amendment for the House Bill 2091. Well, you will have in front of you.
one point.
And the Dash One amendment was trying to fix a specific problem with the bill, that in order for the account to have and acquire its own interest, it needed to be established by as an independent account altogether, and not only have the interest identified as such. However, we have been in discussions with the Secretary of State, as well as with the State Treasurer and the Legislative Fiscal Office on different ways of the solutions for this issue. And today, although House Bill 2091 and the Dash One Amendment establishes this framework, it seems like there are discussions of how to do it differently. And we have, today I asked Drummond Kahn, who is the Interim Director of the Audits Division of the Secretary of State, to come and talk to you and update you on these issues, so he would be able to explain it in more auditing kind of detail to you.
Okay.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Drummond Kahn. I'm the Interim Director of the Oregon Audits Division in the Secretary of State's office. It is a glorious day, not just the product of the day and the year, but also the chance to speak to you about imputed interest. It warms my little audit heart.
I'm sorry I got up this morning.
We're dealing here, ladies and gentlemen, with a very small amount of money that involves interest that unspent audit money spins off, and how we treat that interest once it's received. Money comes to us with particular strings attached to it, particularly money from our partners in the federal government. We assess some agencies for audits we do. We also have some agencies we direct bill. For example, the Department of Human Services pays an assessment every year that covers audits, whether we audit them a certain amount or not, while ODOT, for example, because of the highway fund, pays us hour by hour for the hours we work for them. Based on how we budget audits and how we plan our year versus what's actually spent, there's sometimes money left over. If the leftover money came from federal funds, it has to be treated and spent differently than money that came from the general fund. And I came up with what I think is a useful example, and in the spirit that Mazen began with, I'd like to share that with you. If you're a student and you receive, let's say, a $1,000 scholarship, but it's just supposed to be for books, okay, it came from a book publisher or something, you take the $1,000, you start your school year, you buy $800 worth of books. You have $200 left over at the end of the year, and you put it in your regular bank account. That $200 earns a little bit of interest. Let's say 50 cents, and that's a pretty good interest rate these days. If that interest amount is spent for something other than books, you can put more of your money at jeopardy, and you've actually violated the terms of the scholarship, not by spending the $200 in the wrong way, but by spending the interest it generated in the wrong way. So all we're trying to do with this bill and similar efforts is to simply put that $200 in a different bucket, so its interest is treated the same way we have to treat the $200 that's remaining. That's all it is. It doesn't reduce or increase, well, it technically reduces the general fund by moving the interest we generate into a different bucket, but anything left over at the end is still returned to the general fund once we've taken into account the federal strings attached. For example, we're not supposed to pay mass transit tax on the payroll for our staff from federal money, but we can pay it from the general fund. So this effort basically gives us firewalls or buckets around the interest that the leftover money generates to make sure that we treat it the same way we're supposed to. Esoteric, but also a lot of fun, I think. So,
thank you. Colleagues, you'll recall that we had a hearing back on February 5th. In which we went over all of these items in some detail. I would not surprise me a whole bunch if some of us had managed to think of other things in the meantime. Representative Berger.
Yeah, I was either not here or I slept through this. And I apologize. I must not have been here because this is So how, if you throw it in this bucket, and some of it is left over from ODOT, and some of it is left over from DHS, and some of it is left over from, you know, state lands or BLM or, you know,
mm-hmm.
how do you take it out of the bucket? Well, in the silos that you have to, or does it just stay and accumulate in the bucket endlessly until some sweep comes along?
No, if you'll look in our testimony in February,
that's
a good question. We essentially explained that if it earns interest, it goes into the bucket. So let's say, for example, our estimate for an annual interest earned is about $60,000. Biennial, it's about $120,000. And this is from our account, which includes money with strings and money without strings.
Exactly.
So let's say $60,000 a year comes in. About $10,000 of that is the federal portion, which is about 16.9-17% of the total. We would reduce the $60,000 by that amount, reduce the $60,000 by about $4,500, which is this mass transit tax, which the feds don't allow but the state does for our payroll. And that leaves $45,500. It would be treated exactly the same way as any other $45,500 once we've taken out the federal and the mass transit money. So it's either spent for general audit purposes as we had planned, as we do now, or it will be returned to the general fund as we do now. It would just come from that bucket. In terms of the frequency of the sweep, I'm imagining that's biennial. I don't know. But it would be treated exactly the same as our current interest account is. The problem now is, our current Secretary of State Audits Division interest account exists as its own bucket, but it's within the general fund, which means that other places can pull from it, maybe not knowing that it has these federal strings attached to it. So no real change, Representative Berger, to the decision making or the sweep itself. It would just be an interest account kept in other funds rather than being mixed in with the general fund.
The point, if I understand it, is to comply with esoteric federal auditing requirements so that we can continue to qualify for the federal funds.
Yes. Technically speaking, Chair Barnhart, Representative Berger, the requirements are for, they're not requirements of auditors per se, they're requirements that the feds use for money they are passing through to state. So this is not really unique to auditing other than that we would have leftover funds based on just the annual spending rate of that money that if they generate interest, kick into these other federal requirements.
And go ahead, Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the idea, if I recall correctly from February, is that we don't end up with an incredible bookkeeping mess. This actually streamlines the process very nicely and prevents us from inadvertently violating the federal law. So it seemed to me back then that it was a good thing because for all the obvious reasons. So I actually do remember the discussion, and I don't remember exactly why that would be the case, Representative, because it is kind of interesting.
Thank you. Yeah, yeah.
Yes, I thought I was peculiar because I remember it, too.
Okay, well, yeah. Sure, Representative Vince, I'm overjoyed that there's this level of interest and appreciation for interest of imputed.
I think it fits in very well with our general understanding that when you accept federal funds, you accept strings, some of which make perfectly good sense and others which you just have to endure. I'm not sure which category this one falls into, but it certainly falls into the latter one. It may fall into the former one as well. I'm not sure.
Right. Mr. Chair,
yes, Representative Berger.
I'd like to comment that he gives us way too much credit. We are not interested in the Audits Division budget. We just want to know where every dime goes.
For the week. That's an excellent news.
That's right. One other question. Do other departments have this kind of problem, and how do they manage it?
An excellent question, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. And I may use this as just a brief advertisement for an audit we're releasing next Tuesday. It's called on March 31st.
And he didn't put me up to it.
I didn't, no. We had not talked before this. Secretary of State Brown will release on March 31st our annual, it's called our statewide single audit, which looks at major federal programs. The state gets about $6.8 billion biennially from the federal government. And we're looking at that pot of money, and about half of the major program, I should say half of the dollars, where federal funds fund major programs in the state, everything from Medicaid and food stamps, National Guard operations, special education. And we're looking in that audit not just at this very small dollar amount of interest requirements, but at a host of the federal requirements that affect it. And we're finding 37 areas where state managers can pay better attention to these other federal rules to make sure that we're not putting the state's share of those federal funds in jeopardy. This is particularly important as we get both stimulus dollars and as new federal money flows in. Very, very important oversight. To be quite blunt, this interest issue is a drop in the bucket compared to the almost $7 billion of federal funds. It is not a huge, I don't lay awake at night worried about imputed interest, but I do worry at night about the state's treatment of federal funds overall. So this is one small ingredient, but you'll see more next week on that general sweep of how Oregon handles federal funds.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm remembering now why I remembered, and it was because of my involvement in a number of not-for-profit organizations on boards of directors where we were challenged to keep track of any number of grants and have to report back. I'm just curious, have you guys put a cost
FTE price on keeping track of the stimulus money coming to the state of Oregon? Will your report state we're going to get all the stimulus money, but just keeping track of all the strings is going to cost this much? I'm just curious about that.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Bence, we don't yet know the extent of the stimulus programs and what would need to be audited to do that. There is a very important question that a nonprofit or a state should ask, which is, what is the cost of compliance? I think in the last bill, Representative Call was asking about the cost to manage, for instance, a $2 million program. And if it's more than $2 million, it may not be worth the grant. So I know that a lot of the national auditing groups, the National State Auditors Association, the Association of Local Government Auditors, are studying this issue of what's it going to cost us to track all the stimulus money. The good news is the federal government's aware of it, and they are really bolstering the federal audit presence, both for states, nonprofits, cities, and counties, to make sure that they, too, are tracking. You know, in some ways, it's their money. It's not money that has come through state tax and being spent by the state. It's federal money coming in. So there's a shared audit burden now with the feds to watch it as well. So I don't have a dollar amount estimate, but I can tell you that there's tremendous interest in both the audit community and at all levels of government to watch this huge influx of money.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The President, of course, suggested that he was going to be watching to make sure all the states were doing exactly what they should be doing. The signal seemed to be he was looking for an example, and so I assume every state's doing its best not to be that example.
Right. Exactly.
Because we don't want to show up in the Times for another reason. Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
As we were discussing these issues, that's basically one of the things that came up as a potential unintended consequence, if you will. So if we have all these federal accounts coming to the state into different agencies, does that mean we keep all agency funds separate for everybody in order to be able to estimate and isolate this imputed interest for each federal grant that comes to the state? And therefore, do we end up with an account for each agency and each section of each agency and so on? So these are the questions that started coming up after we've looked at the bill and the amendment to the bill. So the amendment works in that sense of the structure, but at this time we're still trying to find a solution that could probably do it through the accounting mechanism and not necessarily through the structural mechanism. So at this point, that's the solutions that is being sought, and see if it's feasible to do that instead of isolating all these different accounts, if you will, in the state treasurer. So that's what we would like to report to you today.
Well, have we come up with a solution?
Yeah. We're still very actively employing all the auditing and budgeting and with a slight economist type of thing to it. So we have not yet.
Not yet. All right. Well, Representative Riley.
Yeah, does that imply that we shouldn't be passing this bill today because we're still looking at whether this is the right solution? Is that what I'm hearing?
Representative Riley, we thought we had a solution, but now we know we're mistaken. So we don't have the perfect solution yet, and we don't want to open a new door. So you're correct.
Thank you very much.
All right. So you don't want the bill today?
No, Mr. Chairman. We would prefer to hold it.
Okay.
To another day.
All right. It's a useful conversation. And I assume the Secretary of State's office is engaged in working on that problem.
Mr. Chair, yes, Secretary of State Business Services Division is working with Treasury, happy to work with LRO as well. The issue, as we heard it expressed, was one of consistency. You know, if this sub-account is set up,
right.
Not particularly a concern of ours in that we're here today simply to say we have this problem. I don't know the extent to which it applies to other agencies, but as they're working on it, that's...
Will we get an answer reasonably soon?
Yes, Mr. Chair. We would like to come with an answer. So when we present this, and hopefully this structure is ready, basically we're telling you it's ready to move. But when we move it, if we move it, we don't want to come up and say, whoops, next time we've done something.
And, of course, this bill cannot be used in a more general way because of the relating clause. So if you come up with a more general solution, we'll need to figure out some other way to put it over to the Ways and Means Committee.
That's correct.
All right. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I guess that means that we'll close the work session on House Bill 2091.
Pleasure to be with you.
And we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 3203. Paul, this is one of yours, huh?
Very good.
Chair, I'm coming in as the closer.
Yes, sir.
Left-handed closer or the right-handed closer?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the House Bill 3203, you had posted for public hearing yesterday and carried over to today. What it does is pretty straightforward. It expands the Revenue Department's authority to provide information to other state agencies responsible for administering laws under ORS 670.600. And that particular statute is the one that defines an independent contractor. So that's the gist of the bill. If you look at the current statute, what the bill does is expand the list of agencies or situations and circumstances in which the Department of Revenue can share information for tax administration and compliance purposes. And if you look in Section 1 toward the end, you can see on page 3, lines 19 and 20, it's any other state agency responsible for the administration or enforcement of laws requiring the application and provision of the statute referring to definition of independent contractors. One other thing I might add is I have talked with the Department of Revenue. They are also working on a similar bill or similar concept in House Bill 2815, which deals with also the issue on independent contractors. And that bill is actually ironically scheduled for a work session today, and it has a subsequent to the Revenue Committee. So my suggestion would be, and also the Department of Revenue suggestion, would be to consider these two bills in tandem, since they're trying to deal with a similar policy issue.
Well done.
I like it.
Yes.
Apologize.
Well, we are open, and Jody Weiser and Peggy Woolsey signed up yesterday. I don't see either of them here.
No.
Is there anyone else who would like to be heard this morning on House Bill 3203? Otherwise, it would be my intent to do exactly what you suggest, and that is to schedule these bills together for further discussion, and we may hear from those witnesses at that time. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if now is an appropriate time to ask staff if we could, at some point, as soon as possible.
Yesterday.
No. Have a list of all the contractors, a size of the universe here, okay? Agencies know, you know, how big is the universe of people under this statute that are directly, okay? And who are they?
I do know that Representative Holvey's committee has been working pretty hard on this issue.
It could be there.
They may already have that.
Yeah, they may already have it, but if they haven't asked, I'm asking now.
Yeah. Okay. I agree with you. I think we should ask.
Okay.
Yeah. I do know from private conversations that Representative Holvey thinks this is an important issue, and I don't think he would if there weren't a fair number of them.
Yeah.
Anything else for this public hearing today? If not, we'll close the public hearing. And we're meeting next on Monday? Is that right? We're meeting
next. Yes, Mr. Chair, we're meeting on Monday.
We're meeting next on Monday. And with that, the committee is adjourned.